All right. Okay. The large lady. The large lady. Okay. Whenever the foxes give a party, people eagerly come. In the fox's big, messy house, people feel good. Marty Fox has a born in California ease, and Judy's uncorrected Brooklyn accent here in New England seems as warm as pastrami. They are attentive hosts, just as they are attentive parents. Their three sons nevertheless cause them some worry. Okay, the foxes. Tell us about the foxes.
Got a lot in.
Yeah, she really does.
It got worse. By the time I read like the next two paragraphs, I thought, like, how many characters is she introducing at the beginning of the story?
Yeah. But what do we know about them so far?
They entertain a lot.
Yes. So people, they're comfortable giving parties. They're really good hosts. And people like to be in their house. They create a comfortable atmosphere for people. And what about Marty and Judy? They come from different,
right,
you know,
like,
you know, one is Brooklyn, one is California, so we'll see some things there. We're going to have sort of a, it's like the profile of a few marriages in here, right? So this is the first one.
Did you find warm as pastrami an odd description?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
I mean,
what was she trying to do there?
Helps just building on the Brooklyn Jewish, I think.
Brooklyn Jewish, yeah. You know, there are certain things,
But that's Jewish everywhere.
Smell, taste, I don't, yeah.
I find pastrami tough. So, like a warmest pastrami, I wasn't working for him because I find it's just an annoying food.
It's an odd.
I don't like it, obviously.
It's an odd, what, simile? Yes.
Yeah,
you would say like warm as the sun or something like that, but pastrami, yeah, it kind of does it. Yes,
right.
It is jolting. Yes, yes. Why did she want to jolt us?
She always wants to jolt us.
She always wants. This is true. Now, what about the uncorrected Brooklyn accent? What does that tell you?
That she's not assimilating to New England.
Right.
Definitely stand out.
She stands out.
And it's a negative.
Very comfortable. These people are very comfortable people.
Yeah.
You know, have you ever been to somebody's house that's not particularly put together? But you feel comfortable because it makes you feel at home.
Yeah.
And they're just comfortable people.
Yeah.
By saying it's an uncorrected accent means it's wrong.
Yes. In other words, it should have been corrected. Why wasn't
if these people have Boston accents, you know, who are they?
Excuse me.
If you have no accent at all, you know, wherever they say part of the country where there's no accent at all, you can say, wow, but they have an accent.
Yeah, uncorrected.
So something negative about
it. Yeah, yeah, like somehow she should have corrected it, but she didn't. Okay. People with gratifying children, Marlene Winokur observes on the Friday night of the Fox's party, arouse the wrath of their friends. Isn't that great?
That's great.
That is so great. Hmm, says her husband, Paul, radiologist and colleague of Marty Fox. And then, really? Okay, so we have the second marriage. What do we got here?
Well, he's a doctor.
He's a doctor. He's a radiologist. He and Marty are radiologists together.
And they made sure to mention that.
They what?
They made sure to mention that.
Yes.
And he's a doctor.
Yes, yes. Right. So she's very insightful, and he seems to be a little clueless.
Right.
Like, saying, I'm attending to you, but I'm not really attending to you. And then you really know he wasn't attending because he says, really, because something about that strikes him as you know.
Knew almost.
Yes, yeah.
Could it be that he didn't, he knows her too well and did not want to go there?
Right.
Rather than being clueless. I looked at like, really? Like, really?
Are you really
like,
criticizing like, that? Right.
I live with you, I know you. I'm not getting into you.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, we'll see.
I had that too.
Did you also?
We'll see about this Paul, because we get other information about him. It's not so complimentary later, but we'll see. Okay. In another part of town, Francis Mazmanian, Judy Fox's co-worker at the social service clinic, is writing down their destination for the sitter. It is really amazing how much she packs into a sentence, right? You know, her profession, who she's connected to, the fact that they have children. Right. Okay. Let me ask you a question, says Bill Mazmanian. Why are the Foxes putting themselves to so much trouble? Is it trouble? I was hoping to stay home tonight and grade exams. You'll do that tomorrow, says Francis, turning on him the mild, slightly wall-eyed stare that he loves, or at least remembers having loved. So he does not mind that tomorrow he does not remind her that tomorrow they are going to a Little League game, and tomorrow night to a faculty cocktail party, and Sunday to a neighborhood meeting. Life in the town of Godolphin, Massachusetts is chock-a-block with activity. Bill thinks ungratefully. But how could it be otherwise in a place where so many interesting people choose to live? Okay, so what does he mean, why are the Foxes putting themselves to so much trouble? Why are they putting me to so much trouble, right? This is like, you know, I don't want to go.
No, but also he thinks it would be trouble for him.
Yes. Yes.
If he were doing this, he would look at it.
Yes. Yes. Right. Right. Mm-hmm. I was hoping to stay home. You'll do that tomorrow. Okay. So what's a wall-eyed stare?
I don't know.
It's fish. It's sideways.
She has an extra eye.
It's a fish. It's right. It's
one of her eyes is just.
They go the other way as opposed to cross-eyed. Right. 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 Yeah. So.
How do you see? It must be hard to see with.
Yeah. I'm trying to probably get some glasses to correct it. I don't know.
Slightly.
Okay. Okay. So why doesn't he remind her of all of that? He loves her. Yeah. He's going to go with it. He goes with it. Right. You know, it's Francis. Okay. Bill thinks ungratefully. I love that because clearly he's in a state of, you know, if you're living in Godolphin, Massachusetts, you have to, you know, you're of a certain economic sphere and so on. But sometimes we can still be ungrateful, right? When we have like all the blessings in the world, we can still have moments of ingratitude, right? So Bill is right there with us. You know, all of this activity is great, except, you know, he'd prefer being home tonight to grade his exams. Okay. Now, in the next paragraph, Judy is setting up. She's spreading a Guatemalan cloth on the big oak table. What is that? Why is that so funny?
Well, it sounds kind of hippie-ish to me.
Yes,
you know, it's
yes.
The Mother Earth with a multicolored tablecloth.
And that's
a dolphin.
Yeah, and all of her preparations are just kind of, you know, to put it all together, and it's not a big deal, and she's not getting out the good china. She's just putting out some cups and getting a tray from the deli, and it's just
very
easy.
Right, simple, right, but we also know that, I don't know, maybe at least on the second time we know, that she's hosting a party that's going to be about good works, you know, so let's put out the Guatemalan tablecloth to get us in the mood, you know. Okay, so today, did everybody see it's about 8 lines up? Today, Judy had the further assignment. Mm-hmm. Connie, do you want to read that?
Today, Judy had the further assignment of pushing the living room chairs against the wall and then setting up 25 rented bridge chairs in close rows. All of this work she did unresentfully, her mind busy with one of her clients, a woman whose depression Judy would have liked to relieve.
Okay, so hold there. Mm-hmm. Why did she say all of this work she did unresentfully? Why is Edith Perlman telling us that she's unresentful about this?
Because somebody else, like Pastrami.
Somebody else might have been resentful about this, right? But she, you know, she just kind of goes about it and so on. okay, keep going.
But the woman mourning a wasted youth was as yet inaccessible. Judy had unfolded chairs and swabbed toilets and answered the telephone and thought about her client. And she would have accomplished everything well ahead of time had she not encountered such terrible traffic on her way to and from the airport. And so at 6:30, she was feeling rushed. All so unnecessary, she complained to Marty. Mrs. Fenton told me while we were stuck in the airport tunnel that she never expected to be picked up at all, that the organization always pays for a cab. Why couldn't she have said that on the telephone last night? She was too pickled, said Marty, which reminds me. I bought 3 jars. Kosher Spears? Yes, you wondered how I'd recognize the lady.
Yeah, so hold on there. Okay. She's unresentful about what she's doing until what?
Until she gets off the airport.
Right. Yeah. She could have been saved a trip to the airport, and she wasn't. So now she's a little bit resentful. Not very, but a little bit resentful.
Well, rush hour and the tunnel from the airport. Yeah. I don't blame her.
She didn't resent what she was supposed to be doing, but it was the unnecessary trip.
And, you know, also it's that I left enough time, you know, to go to the airport and everything would have been okay and I would have gotten it all in and, you know, because we're, you know, it's because, well, this is a very benign way. I'm not saying this very judgmentally, but we're all, you know, it's about our schedule. It's about my schedule, you know, and that'll, at least about Ilana Cantor, you know, when I, you know, you put the time and stuff like that and something comes in to, you know, like we're upset about that, right? But that's life, right, of course. But, you know, anyway, so she had prepared and it wasn't good enough. Now, what do we learn about Marty and Judy?
They're good at non sequitur.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, they're close enough that when he makes a joke about her being pickled,
she immediately knows where he's going, right?
You know, because he likes the pickle. So it's kind of, you know, they finish each other's sentences. They know joke number one, you know. So Kosher Spears. Okay. Karin, do you want to just finish that paragraph?
Which reminds me, I bought 3 jars. Kosher Spears? Yes, you wondered how I'd recognize the lady, remember? Wait till you see her. You'll know why I didn't have any trouble. She's as big as a house. What crusader against famine wouldn't be? And as red as a beet. Gray hair scraped into a bun. Glasses, of course, like all of the best people. Her own spectacles twinkled, and an aroma of recent refreshment.
Okay, so we have the introduction of the large lady, right? She's as big as a house. What crusader against famine wouldn't be? What is she saying that?
Sarcastic. You know? Yeah.
Or truthfully in the sense of, you know, the kind of identification with, who knows. As red as a beet, okay. And so what's the recent refreshment?
Mouthwash.
Yeah, mouthwash.
Yeah,
right.
I thought that the gray hair scraped into a bun was a very artificial sentence. People don't talk that way. Writers talk that way. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's not something that seems to me that a person would use bold to describe. Pulled into a bun, in a bun.
Right. Right. Although remember that she's talking to the husband who she knows when he makes a joke about pickled 3 jars. So it might be their language. Could be, maybe not.
But it's interesting that they know this about this woman. So either they've met her before, but no, because how is she recognized? But the reputation apparently precedes her.
Right. Or they heard it on the phone, or
they heard it from the people in Denver
who came beforehand. Right. Okay. Jenny, do you want to keep going?
Mouthwash, Judy nodded, preceded by bourbon. She seems eager and clumsy and kind. She was kind to Ricky, who came with me. She and Ricky counted all the no-looks both. Did you bring up the movie screen from the basement? Yes, but not the slide projector. She's wearing a navy blue suit, big shoulders, shiny skirt. She looks like a visiting nurse. Are you kidding? Visiting nurses these days are snappy little shiksas with advanced degrees. Judy smiled as she was meant to. You make good use of your two Yiddish words. Marty smiled back. I'll get the projector.
Okay, so here I want a little help a little
What's
bit.
Yeah,
What's the other?
We get that later.
Oh, we're going to get it, right? Yeah, we'll get it at the end.
I forgot.
Okay, when she says, first she says, but not the slide projector, and goes right back into the conversation because, again, you know, they communicate information and then they have the talk, and it's just the way they are. She looks like a visiting nurse. Visiting nurses these days are snappy little shiksas with advanced degrees. What does that tell us about Marty?
Judgmental?
Yeah,
he doesn't know much Judaism if she's saying those are the only two Jewish words, Yiddish words you know.
But doesn't mean you don't know Jewish.
I was noticing women.
Well, I don't know about that. Yiddish.
He's a doctor, so he's talking about his experience with nurses.
Right.
In a slightly derogatory
way. Yeah, and noticing what women look like and what they
look like. I found myself a little offended.
Yeah.
I think my first instinct was, oh.
Yeah.
Like if I heard someone say that to me, I would have been like, oh.
Yeah. I wanted to ask because it's a particular thing that I hate. Yeah, I hate that word. I just, you know what it means. Sure, yes, everybody knows what it means. Yeah. It means an abomination. Yeah. And, you know, I think that many people who use the word don't know what it means.
Yeah, right.
They
right,
just think course. It means a non-Jewish woman. Yeah. Right. Right. So, with the shiksas with advanced degrees. Right, so here's a doctor commenting on the nurses. He's looked at them, so he knows, and snappy little. Now, what does it mean Judy smiled as she was meant to?
Maybe it's for her benefit that he knew that it would bring a smile.
Yes, as she was meant to, yeah. Was she kind of going along with it, or was she?
Sometimes people, or I don't know, maybe me, I don't know, that when somebody says something offensive, it hits me and I will sometimes not happily chuckle, but I don't mean it like I'm agreeing with them, but I do this like little, I have a nervous chuckle sometimes. Mm-hmm. I've been, you know, I know that with my kids and stuff, it's like I don't like what they say, but I don't know how to respond, it's like a nervous chuckle. I don't know.
I sort of took it as they were simpatico, because I did not find it as offensive as you did.
Okay.
I thought, you know, the typical visiting nurse is kind of an old frumpy person dragging from, you know, house to house somewhere. And he's saying, no, now they're these, you know, young girls, you know, with advanced degrees. It's not like the old frumpy lady. And he used kind of what I thought was humorous and not insulting, descriptive description of what they are.
Yeah.
And he knew that she would find that funny too, so.
Okay, so that they're on the same page.
It's interesting. Okay. I mean, you know, it's interesting how different that could be.
Yeah. Or maybe she was just chuckling, a smile, because he used a Yiddish word.
Yeah, that could be
too. That's what I thought, not what the word meant, but just that it was Yiddish.
That this would be unusual, right, okay. Barry, do you want to keep going about the bourbon?
About the bourbon, Judy was wrong. And Mrs. Benton braced herself with. Not so very often. A quick one at lunch, another long day at lunch, a few for dinner, and a good many at bedtime. But the nightcaps didn't count. Neither did the cocktails. Neither did the new type snort. She drank less at lunch than most businessmen she'd met. It was only the mid-afternoon pick-me-up that indicated the incipient problem. But it was only incipient. It was incipient only. And if a bottle or two were part of the provisions that she brought to the compound when it was time for her tour of duty, well, those bottles were just restoratives rather like the volumes of Whitman that her closest friend dragged along everywhere, or like the Reverend's needlework. Doilies, antimacassars, tablecloths, the man of God crocheted everything. His blind fingers, he claimed, enabled his body to keep still and his heart to refrain from, not from breaking, he said with a smile, to refrain from showing its heels. Terrible metaphor, carped the Whitman scholar. Walt would have thrown it out.
Okay, so did you all know what an anteme?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that was news to me. That was great.
That word.
How do I know that word?
Sure, we know.
From reading English literature in college, I guess. I don't.
People have them. Grandmothers had them.
Not my Bobby, but
yeah. I just didn't know. I mean, I've seen them a million times, but I didn't. They didn't know the name. It's covers for the back of a
chair.
Sometimes on the arms.
That's what I think of.
I looked it up.
So he crochets all of these things.
So weird.
Okay. Well, so first of all, notice what she did at the top there. She did something hysterical, but what she did was she changed the narrator. Mm-hmm. Like she just like slipped the new narrator in there in such a smooth way. That was just so great. Mrs. Fenton. What about Mrs. Fenton?
She's an alcoholic.
She likes her mix.
Most businessmen she met.
She sounded pickled.
Right.
It's an incipient problem. Right. It's not a real problem. Right. She's right. Not really.
Right. Yeah, I don't really have a problem. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not a problem. Right, and so knowing the kind of work that she's in, you know, we might think, oh, she's self-medicating, you know, can't, you know. Right. Now, what does it mean to refrain from showing its heels? Well, showing your heels.
Walking out.
Yeah, running away, turning away. The other way. Mm-hmm. So he's saying he's not, but what would he mean by that? Even if it's a terrible metaphor, that his heart would go away, you know, that he'd become hardened or something. Yeah, he's not going to let the heart break, because you can't do that work. But you can become, you know, your heart shows
or
you the back of it.
Give up the work
itself
because it's too painful.
Right.
And walk away from it.
Right. So everybody has their way of coping. He's got the crocheting, somebody's got the poetry, and she has the alcohol. Okay, let's see. Sandra, you wanna keep going?
Lying shoeless on the bed, Mrs. Fenton reviewed the situation. Her black dress, only slightly odorous under the arms, hung in the closet. The case of slides was safe in one corner of the room. It had been lugged upstairs by young Ricky, who had then wanted to open it and play with its contents. When she had said no, he had given her a winsome, effeminate look. She had said no again, and he had scampered off, thoroughly boyish. Damn all kids.
And we know, she says, the case of slides was safe in one mm-hmm. corner of the room, except it was not safe, right? Right. Ina, do you want to keep going?
Yes. She would not have anything to drink now. The good people downstairs would provide wine and a light supper, and after the presentation, she would not write to her daughter nor her grandchildren. They have to wait till tomorrow. She would not itemize her expenditures from this fundraising trip. Could wait until Monday, when the secretary of the New York headquarters might give her a hand. She would not read, she would not think, she would simply lie here, peaceably, gazing into a sort of affection at her feet in her snagged stockings. Women in the compound hospital often lay like this, down the threads of wasted bodies they commune with their own toes.
Okay. So what's the she would not, she would not, she would not? Well, she likes to put things off, you know, to a little bit, and preferably for when somebody might be able to either help her or do it for her. But she sees, you see her identifying with the people in the hospital, right? And she's, you know, They have large parts of them, and she has large parts of her, but when they lie down, you know, they can just sort of look at their toes. But she definitely has that identification.
Except earlier, just before this paragraph, she says, damn all kids. And her whole life work, of course, is to be raising money to stop starvation so the kids don't have the extended family.
Right.
And didn't we have something about her, the wife saying how nice she was to the kids to or something?
Right.
Yes, right. She was so nice to Ricky.
The no-nukes.
Who becomes Ricky the Wicked.
Yeah, right.
That's so fun. Okay, Gail.
People started to arrive at 7. Judy and Marty soon regretted their decision not to serve cocktails. The guests moved awkwardly among the rows of bridge chairs. A few collected in the small space between the front row and the movie screen. One woman reached out and scratched the harsh white surface. I can't help thinking that movies are in the screen, she confessed to a friend. Me too. And music is in the piano. French words are in the plume. Of your aunt, murderous thoughts are in the couch of the You are very silly ladies, said Bill Mesmenian. Women, corrected one of them. However, Bill went on, scholarly ideas really are in the typewriter. They reside there, and sometimes I have a devil of a time teasing them out. Is there anything like a drink around here?
Okay. So what is Edith Perlman telling us here? This is the kind of area where if you call women, you don't call them ladies, you definitely don't call them girls, you call them women. So that's one thing. What about two?
They're educated.
They're educated. They go to therapy. You know, it's a certain,
They know French.
They know French, right. Okay. Only Marlene Winokur, sole smoker in the college, seemed relaxed.
She only has her vice.
Where's the speaker? She puffed at Marty. I haven't the fuckiest, he told her. He found his wife in the front hall. When is Mrs. Fenton coming down? I've never heard that. Have you heard that? I haven't the fuckiest.
It's okay.
That was kind of new. But he's also, he doesn't have a problem, you know, speaking in a certain way. I'm to call her when everyone is here.
It's back to the tablecloth. These are hippies.
Right, okay. Let's see, Lynn, do you want to keep going? Marty greeted, actually skip down to Marty said, you wake her up, I have to review. Oh, okay, or you can start from the top, that's fine too.
Okay. Marty greeted another couple. Then it was Judy's turn. The Foxes didn't confer again for another 5 minutes. By that time, everyone had arrived except for the Satterthwaites, who were always late.
Okay, so you know who the people are who get, right? You know, these people have been together for a long time. You know who's going to be late. And I was trying to do something with that name, but other than the word wait, you couldn't, you know. These are the people that you have to wait for.
The last names are all like mouthful to say.
Yes.
I don't know why.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
They're also not Jewish.
They're all different ethnic groups.
You have Armenian, and you have Satterthwaite is like WASPy, I guess.
British.
It's not just a bunch of
Right. It's a diverse. Winokur and Fox also.
And Fox, yeah.
Right. Okay. Keep going.
Okay. Marty said, you wake her up. I have to review my introduction. Judy said, okay, but Mrs. Fenton was already on her way down. It is the rare person who can descend the stairway with grace. Mrs. Fenton, Judy thought, was to be praised. She was wearing a black wool dress of the sort that 30 years earlier, Judy's mother had dragged out for second-rate luncheons. Flashing from its front was a diamond pin. Her outfit included a pair of scuffed brown sandals. Forgive my shoes, Mrs. Fenton said, one hand gripping the banister. I forgot to pack my good ones. Judy said brightly, heavens.
Okay, so why were we laughing so much there?
Well, the dress was that her mother would have dragged out for second-rate luncheons.
Right.
And praise for staying erect. And the
staying erect.
Right.
For staying erect.
Not falling down the stairs.
And the diamond pin with sandals. What's
really this? Scuffed. No, and I put, the woman doesn't have as many pair of shoes. I forgot to pack my good ones.
Right. Right. One. So, when you have a sentence that begins, it is the rare person, you know, who can walk and chew gum. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, it says something about something really rare. It is the rare person who can descend a stairway with grace, you know, who's not clumsy. And she goes on. But it's not necessarily, even though she's saying all these things, you get the impression that she might not be saying it with a judgmental,
right.
You know, yeah. It's right. Just, you know, it's just a fact.
Scene.
Yes,
yeah.
Right.
And she
right.
makes, she tries to make her comfortable when she
yes.
says, I forgot to pack my good ones, and she goes, heaven.
Yeah, right, right.
So who cares, you know?
Right.
It happens.
Yeah.
Well, and she is a therapist, you know, because we've already
heard right.
her. Right, yeah. Right.
So she's going to be kind to people and look at the best.
Right, right, right. Ruth, do you want to keep going?
Sure. Judy, oh, Mrs. Fenton's other hand was grasping the handle of the case of slides. Mm-hmm. Now, trying to steady its weight against her thigh, she lost hold of her burden and it dropped. The catch, which Ricky must have been fooling around with, flew apart and the lid opened slightly and some of the slides spilled down the stairs. They're numbered, said Mrs. Fenton consolingly. Mrs. Fenton watched while the wife in the plain brown tunic retrieved the slides. The husband, now what on earth was the name of these people? That's Maurice? No, that had been the Chicago pair. The husband turned from whatever he'd been reading and moved forward to greet her as she reached the bottom stair. Fox? No, they were in Denver. Good evening, Mrs. Fenton. They shook hands. What had those busy fingers done too recently, she wondered. Which orifices did they confidently enter? Or perhaps this fellow was the pathologist. She had been lodged with so many doctors. Green glass, she remembered with relief.
Right.
And
so,
after...
Oh, so yeah. So Fitzmaurice. Okay, so the Chicago pair. So she's kind of spilling out over, even with Ricky, you know, she's kind of spilling over. And, but she can't remember the names. She can't remember the names. Now, of course, that makes so much sense, right? Because you're going from one to the other to the other. And yet, you know, that's like something that if you're in the business, you know, that's not a small thing. That is not a small thing.
She's very burned out by this whole thing.
Yes.
She didn't even consult to see what their names were.
Right, right. I know. She doesn't even bother looking. She could look it up, but she doesn't want. Right, right. Okay. Judy, do you want to keep going?
And after my few words, he was saying, we'll turn out the lights and let the presentation begin. Is that how you want it? Yes, the pledge cards. Their little table is on the way to the dining room. There are some others in a box near the wine, in vino caritas. I hope so. Oh, she was thirsty. She took the slide case from the hands of her hostess and stepped into the living room. Fortunately, the projector and her chair were near the entrance.
Okay, so when it says in vino caritas, what does that mean?
In wine, there's
true. That's very
charity. They're giving. They're giving. And she says, I hope so. What does she mean?
The wine.
She means the wine. You'd think she meant all the contributions that they're going to give.
Yeah.
But, you know, I hope so. Okay, right. Judy, you want to keep going?
Do you want to see how the thing works? She couldn't design a cistern or speak much Somali, but she could handle any goddamn projector anybody gave her. However, she allowed him to review the mechanism of his toy. Most of the green glasses guests were seated by now, facing the screen, their backs toward her. Some looked over their shoulders to smile a welcome. Then they faced forward again, for the doctor had made his way to the front of the room.
Okay. So, why is she upset about that? She could handle any goddamn projector anybody gave her.
Because he wants to show her.
Yeah, she doesn't like the assumption that she, you know, she does this all the time. Why is he assuming? You know, so, and she is very judgmental. You know, like, they're not so about her, but she is about them.
I think it's interesting that they say, for the doctor, and it's made his way, as opposed to naming him.
She didn't know his name. She had the wrong name to begin with.
Oh, it's because she's speaking. I'm thinking of the narrator speaking.
I thought it was the doctor has made his way toward the front of the room. You know, so we're all going to face forward now.
See, I just thought it was, she assumed that he was a doctor originally because so many of her hosts were doctors, and this was, he was in the role. Now it's, you know, the doctor's going up.
Okay.
They're always doctors.
Ruth, do you want
to? Mrs. Fenton never listened to the introductory remarks. Since they were all derived from the same mimeograph sheet, they were pretty much alike. The excellent work of the organization with its 3 Asian and 7 African outposts, the continued need for more support, emotional as well as, of course, financial. The career of today's representative, Alice Mary Fenton, a former school teacher who 15 years ago, recently widowed, responded to a call for workers, has served in no particular order and sometimes simultaneously as teacher, administrator, nurse, cook, gardener, teletype operator, jeep driver, labor arbitrator, and practitioner of minor surgery. Ripple of laughter. The members of the organization staff spend some portion of every year back in this country interviewing recruits and trying to raise money. Mrs. Fenton is on her stateside tour now. Mrs. Fenton?
Right. Mrs. Fenton. And then the dog's body rose. Thank you, she said to her host. So she's going through, she's going to slip again into Mrs. Fenton's mind, but here she's in Marty's mind.
I thought that the description of everything she did was sort of at odds with how we were seeing her up till then, which is kind of like a burned out fundraiser traveling from place to place. And then they're describing her as this person who was pitching in and doing all this work out in the field.
Right.
That was a good role.
Right.
Now she's just,
burned out. Right. She's been there for 15 years. She's been doing this for 15 years, so we could see how she could be burned out. But the dog's body rose. You know, this is in his mind, this is what he's thinking about her. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. Distended bellies. Ruth, do you want to keep going from there?
Distended bellies, began Mrs. Fenton, reside on every coffee table. Marlene Winokur caught the allusion just as Mrs. Fenton, having swallowed, began her second sentence. I speak, of course, of Life, the New York Times magazine section, she clarified, and other periodicals and television. The media, which should excite our sympathies, in fact, benumb them. Here is it Digo? Digo's belly. The voice was neutral, thought Marlene. No, not neutral, unforceful, a slight hoarseness. Digo is 6. It never fails to amaze me that not eating can make you fat. He came to the compound the day before this picture was taken. Here is a slide of him some weeks later. And sure enough, the child's proportions had improved. Not all our stories have happy endings, but this one did.
So in addition to all those things that she did, now we understand, particularly with that, the media, which should excite our sympathies, in fact, benumb them. This is a very bright woman. You know, this is a bright woman, and she also, you know, what we see now and what we're going to continue to see is she really knows how to make a presentation. You know, she knows how to do this. And not all of our stories have happy endings, but this one did, right? Madeline?
You have seen pictures like this before, a mass of starving children. They look pregnant, don't they? But malnutrition comes in other forms. The woman crouching on the straw mat was shapeless because of her wadded garments, but the infant in her arms was all bones. Paolo could not be saved. Here is Luan. About 13, anorexic, but not from nerves. The people of Luan's tribe subsist on rice and bananas. During famines, they try to eat roots and leaves. I have seen, in the operating room, a child whose esophagus had been perforated by the twigs she attempted to swallow. She was so desperate, so willing to die. Mrs. Fenton paused. Why did she allow herself to relive that moment? Herself holding the retractor ready to faint, and the nurse turning white above her mask. Later, cradling the little girl in her arms, Mrs. Fenton had wished that the child could have looked upon, last upon a prettier face than her own. What sentiment? The eyes had been blind with dying.
So, you know, she's telling this story, and she's wondering, it's a hard, you know, who could not be moved and heartbroken by listening to this story? But she's having done it so often, she can just do it, and she's wondering, why do I keep doing this? Because it's hard for her to do this. But you also understand that because she has been doing this so often, she can let her mind wander a little bit.
Yes, but she's not so burned out that she's totally immune to all of those feelings.
Right, right. She clicked the sides. Three sentences per slide was a satisfactory tempo, but sometimes she speeded things up. You know, she knows exactly, you know, she and her slides, this is a well-oiled machine. I mean, three sentences. No, if she wants to speed things up, she cuts it to two. There are two diseases commonly associated with starvation. Gassum lying on his cot. These are the slides, right? Everybody got this. Like, she's speaking and then the slides. Mm-hmm. In marasmus, the torso swells while the limbs waste. Raynaud, hooked to an IV. In kwashiorkor, the body develops open sores. Children impassively allow flies to land on their sores. Tiny Asha, who in fact had recovered and been sent home, permanently dulled on the back of her father. Okay, how many of you knew about the two forms of starvation? You did? Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Because of Errol's medical thing,
right.
People sort of went with it.
Right, yeah. Right, right. right. So
I didn't know they could actually, where she's just permanently dulled. I assume that means there's brain damage. And I didn't know those from starvation.
Yeah, from when I was looking at, I didn't know those names. So the kwashiorkor, it can do not acute brain damage, but it can do some, affect you mentally in addition to physically. Which apparently is not so with the marasmus. The parents of these afflicted children, though familiar with death and in particular with infant mortality, still feel, much as we would, that they are letting their offspring down. I mean, you can see she really has insight and empathy and sympathy for all of this. Otherwise, she wouldn't know to say these words. But of course it is we who are letting them down, we whose overconsumption is malnourishing the world. Did you know that the average North American consumes five times as much grain as the average third world person, much of it in the form of meat, chicken, and eggs? That was something that Yitz Greenberg was advocating. Oh, yeah. That was a surprise last night. Vegetarianism, or better eating. That we foolishly nourish our cattle on this useful grain instead of on green stuffs that humans can't eat anyway. When I see red meat on the tables of Americans, I want to puke. She wouldn't puke much around here, thought Marty. He and Judy got high on soybeans and fish. Of course, people avoid the more wasteful foods when they give parties for the organization. Judy, who served the same delicatessen fare to everybody, even Marty's chief, nevertheless bowed her head. So what's going on here?
Criticized.
Yeah, she feels, and this is totally intentional, right? She is pouring on the guilt. Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, I when I see red meat on the tables of Americans, I want to puke. And don't think I don't know that you put on a little show for us here. I know everything that goes on.
Well, I went back to look. All she had was a tray of like turkey and cheese. It wasn't even this bountiful.
Yes, which Mrs. Fenton will tuck into, you know.
Oh, right.
And Mrs. Fenton's overweight.
Yes.
So who is she to talk?
So, okay.
And you have to think that if you're part of an audience and someone is doing a fundraising speech, and they're, you know, very overweight and they're talking about malnutrition,
the calories in the liquor.
That must be it.
Beautiful. So Judy, who served the same delicatessen fare to everybody, she bowed her head. In other words, she doesn't put on, she was falsely accused here, right? Mm-hmm. Because she doesn't put on any airs. This is what she serves you know, anybody who comes in the house. And it doesn't matter who you are when you come into her house, but she still feels badly. Of the two, said Mrs. Fenton, showing a hideous picture of a pair of adult sufferers, Marasmus is the more heartrending, Kwashiorkor the more repellent. It's hard not to shudder, the suggestible Marlene shuddered. But whether we shudder in compassion or disgust is difficult to tell. I myself am continually disgusted, she said with momentary agitation. Here's our refectory, she said more calmly. That's my best friend in the pith helmet, she said, glad that the show was nearly over, aware that once again she had been on the road too long. So, you know, the show was over. You know, there's, I remember when I was working at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and this is in the days where, you know, you walked in Memorial Sloan Kettering and you were going to die. So you would go to the children's ward, which of course was the worst. And, you know, people there were, you know, they would make jokes. They would make jokes because, you know, not to a parent and not in the, you know, but when they were by themselves, they had to, you know, because you know. That's my best friend in the pith helmet, she said. So she has a best friend, so that's nice to know. Why is she saying we don't know whether it's disgust or heart, you know, compassion? I myself am continually disgusted. Well, she's trying to get them to be real about this. You know, we have different reactions to that. And I'm going to tell you that if you felt disgusted, that's something that I feel too. But that's also going to, you know, I'm like you, and she's going to do that again. But and she's going to use that to say, now you have to be like me. You're not going to work there, but you're going to contribute. Judy's sympathy shifted from the victims, who were pictures, to Mrs. Fenton, who was suffering right here in their house. And of course, that's what we do, right? Right? People who are close to us, that's when we really feel suffering. Perhaps later that evening, she would invite Mrs. Fenton into the little sewing room. The children always felt soothed there. Mrs. Fenton could talk. Her looseness would be appropriate, even helpful, when they were alone together. And Judy would listen. Now all she could do was help her guests bring the presentation to an end. We have been criticized for speaking so much about the worst. The front door slammed, the Satterwhites elaborately tiptoeing, hung up their coats. Okay, go to the left, to the right side of the page. She's talking about how people who live in the compound are, you know, they're not perfect. They can be malicious. They can be sly, ungrateful. In her mind, often I hate them. Also, they can be merry. Also, I hate you. You know, so she's between what she says and what she thinks. You know, there are two conversations going on here. She pushed irritably at a jam slide. The screen revealed its next to last picture, the Reverend and his patient's chorus. But we must speak more of the worst than of the good, because otherwise it is impossible. And here her already harsh monotone became yet more harsh, to move people to give us money. I have come to ask for contributions, as you know. If I could, she rasped, I would turn you all upside down and shake you until bank books came out of your mouth. For you are, you know, greedy, selfish, and unchristian. Judy wondered whether now was the moment to intervene. just as I am. Marty was sorry the burp. A snort might calm the lady down. I too am sinful. I am large. I embrace multitudes. I would not try to induce guilt.
Right.
That's like people when they say, with all due respect, they say something very disrespectful. Right. Damn right, thought Paul Winokur, who every day retarded the spread of cancer in numerous patients. I am begging. Marlene Winokur felt herself blush. So, Paul, what's with Paul?
He's helping, not me. I'm doing good things.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So there's this poem that I give to everybody who I can give. It's about Rabbi Jack Reamer and Rabbi Harold Kushner wrote it together. It's about the Shema, and it's a whole poem about people who hear but don't really hear. And one of the instances is when the rabbi gives a sermon and somebody thinks it's addressed to somebody else. Right? This is not, she's not talking about me, says Paul. You know, damn right. And he's angry about it, right? I do things. On the other hand, his wife, it's a different story. A long pause. Then Mrs. Fenton's voice continued, before we join the green glasses repast, here is the final slide. This boy was perhaps 3. He was crying. Because he was crying, his lids were lowered, and the usual compelling sight of a pair of large eyes was denied to the viewers. His head was bald, probably shaved, thought Marty Fox. He thought of the parasites that infest the scalp, and then he thought of the ones that make their home in the organs, the trematodes, the nematodes. So this is Marty, right? She keeps going, you know, she goes from one mind to the other, but you know exactly who's thinking or who's speaking. The small boy's open, unhappy mouth could have been any youngster's mouth, or at least any black youngster's. Despite malnourishment, the lips retained their negroid fullness. Marty took note of that, but it was not so much the desolate expression that made the child an effective emblem of deprivation. His picture had already been chosen by the organization for next year's poster. This is the kind of, you know, that's gallows humor, right? That we're all, you know, we want to, yeah. But his arms, oh, the sticks. Marty kept examining them. The room was silent. God had not meant arms to attain such a disarticulated state. The joints were still sizable, though. Marty was reminded of a tinker toy, the fists. The fists pressed against the temples. You could feel the despair. The child's knuckles touched his forehead. It was a universal gesture. Thus have old men grieved for their ruined houses of worship, their conquered cities. Thus grieved the little Schwarza for his life. There's the second Yiddish word. Now, is there any context in which Schwarza is not offensive?
In German.
Yeah, right. But I think in, you know,
not here.
And, you know, so, and she's showing us that contradiction. He is totally relating to that picture, Tinker Toys. He's totally relating to it, you know, and then he says something like this. And that's all of us, right? We all have the compassionate side, and then we all have the side that, you know, maybe we don't like to show everybody, you know, but these are real people. Judy thought, we're not so bad, but Marlene thought, we are wrong. Paul Winokur endured a moment of panic when he couldn't find his wife's tussle of hair, but then he saw it, all filaments against the whitening walls. Marty Greenglass, naked, a fox, was turning on the lights. At that moment, Marty could have renounced the world. Francis Mathmanian did resolve to do just that, and though with time their passion weakened and their resolutions faded, they never forgot their feelings on seeing the little boy, nor were their contributions to a variety of relief associations ever less than generous. The pledges to the organization that night were large, and the conversations during sandwiches and wine subdued. One woman, the woman who had scratched the movie screen in order to liberate the image within, was unable to talk or eat at all. Even when she saw Mrs. Fenton tucking into a turkey in Russian, Bill Mazmanian agreed with the man who, indicating Mrs. Fenton with his thumb, remarked that lofty ends may rely on low instruments. It was, after all, an old truth. A newer truth did occur to Bill. It had to do with all these kindly and generous friends of his who did not conspicuously consume, who did wonder about the nature of the good life, who gave time and money feelingly. Hell gapes for the merely empathic. That was what Bill was beginning to think. But since there was no typewriter handy to release its opinions on the matter, Bill lost hold of the idea before the evening was out.
The description of the boy reminding him of a tinker toy, that really was very meaningful. I mean, it just got to me.
Yeah. So what is she trying to say? from?
I kind of get the feeling, you know, we have lots of friends and we can comment about them and whatever and know their little idiosyncrasies, but the truth is these were giving, kind people. You know, as much as everybody's got their little shtick, this was, they're, truthfully, they've got good hearts. That's the way I kind of summed it up, maybe.
I didn't understand the Bill's feeling that that hell gapes for the merely empathic. I mean, they were all sympathizing, but they were all giving money. So where's the hell aspect of this? They didn't, the people out there didn't need their bodies there with, you know, they didn't all need to buy a ticket to Africa.
Right.
What they needed was the money.
Right. I think what he was saying was to merely have empathy and not to do something. They did something
they
about
did something.
It.
Okay.
But hell is open for
that.
That
was a contrast.
Even though they, the part that said it subdues, it does subdue, is in that life where, you know, our hearts are just there, and then time goes by and we do subdue a little bit, but.
Right, because that's life, right? We go on with our lives.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
One of the things that she did, especially in this story, she shows multiple thought processes going on at any one time.
Mm-hmm.
And here there's at least three. So he, you know, somebody's watching what she's presenting. Then they're thinking about, well, what's she really like? And then they're taking it to themselves. Well, I don't do this or I do that. I mean, it's beautifully done.
Yeah, the different reactions. And so here's a group of people. The heart is definitely in the right place. And yet, you know, it's the dilemma that we all have, right? Which is, you know, we can get upset about a small thing. Last week, I forgot to bring the voice recorder, so I was, I was upset about that. So we get upset, and then we see something like this, and we think, oh, you know, how could I possibly be upset about something so small? But that's, it's, you know, that's life. That's how we live. And so I think she's saying both things. She's saying, you know, these are good people. They are good people. But, you know, if you're not over there doing the work, this is what's going to happen. And there's not something wrong with it as long as you do something. The difference between doing something and doing nothing is a world of difference. And our feelings are good, but feelings, you know, only go so far.
That was interesting that she wasn't, she didn't save you'll go to hell for the people who have no empathy and who can look at that and go and walk on. But hell gapes for those who have the empathy and don't act upon it. Mm-hmm. It almost sounds like it's worse than not having a feeling about it at all. It's the worst is to say, oh, isn't that too bad, and walk on rather than, I didn't notice.
But don't you think these people have been exposed to maybe not exactly the same, not the same person, but the same type of fundraising where it really goes right to your gut. They're in a position, either they're doing it through medical, they're doing it through academic, they're doing it, I mean, all of them are
social
fortunate,
social.
You know.
Yeah.
And there is a numbing effect. It's not numbing when you're there listening, but there's a totality
yes.
of,
right.
Oh my God, I'm one person, and
right.
how much more can I do?
Right.
What is enough?
Right. You've probably heard the expression compassion fatigue.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think it's true.
Yeah. Yeah. But in her final sentence, she's talking about writing, right? She's talking about writing, and you know he had a stunning way of saying, you know, that it's not okay not to do something in this life. And he forgot it, right? Because that's what happens when we don't have the pen to write it down. We forget it. On the one hand, she, at least for me, she was 1,000% successful in getting me to, you know, want to cry about child hunger, right? And so she can do that sometimes. And sometimes maybe it eludes her too. You know, maybe, you know, she has an idea and she doesn't write it down for some reason. And that's just, I think she's saying, that's just the way it is. We don't have to say bad, good. This is the way it goes. And also making sure, now why do you think that she was very certain to make sure to say that life in the compound was not perfect? You know, that the people there were not perfect.
It brings reality to it, maybe? Here you're giving and giving and, look, okay, people aren't perfect, but there's a reality.
Also, she's not perfect.
Exactly.
And she's not perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. I mean, the people that they're caring and for weren't perfect.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Because
the messenger.
One of the things that the fundraising depends on is credibility. Mm-hmm. And if you talk about, you know, some hagiographical, you know, the saints of the compound, people are not going to believe you. And it's critical that they believe you, because that's what's going to open them. Now, so I think you know, there's the contrast between the sentence that Bill gets, hell gapes for the merely empathic, versus, and though with time their passion weakened, their resolutions faded, they never forgot their feelings, nor were their contributions ever less than generous. That was okay. It's not as good as we'd like to be, but it's better than others. Now, what about the lofty ends may rely on low instruments?
I thought it was referred to her.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Me too.
Yeah. Totally, right. And they were definitely referring to her, right, right.
And I was confused with that. So,
like lofty ends, meaning this is a really worthy cause.
Right.
And she is not, she's the low instrument, right.
And it wasn't just her. It was the other people who were at the organization that were critical sometimes.
Okay.
That's what I thought. They're not perfect.
Right. But she was.
That's right.
Yes.
I think that's right.
Yes.
Right.
What is it? What's the saying? Perfection gets in the way of good, or something
right.
like
enemy
that.
Enemy of the good. Perfect.
What is
enemy
it?
Of the
yeah.
good is the perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, that's
the
it.
Best is the enemy of the good.
The right. best of you can come out in something that you do. It doesn't mean that you're the best person around. You know.
Right. So there's this midrash that says that it's about talking about a sacrifice, and if a sacrifice has any little blemish on it at all, you can't give it as a sacrifice. It's the rabbi who's teaching this midrash says, what God said was not okay with an animal, he permitted with a human being. Mm-hmm. And then he gives the analogy. A human craftsman, who are, their tools are everything to them, if they have broken tools, then, you know, you have to ask questions about their craft. But with God, God does God's best work with broken tools, which are us, mm-hmm. right? We're the lowly instruments, yeah. all of us. And I think that's, you know, that was her second thing to say. You know, she was a low instrument. We might think we're not so talented at, you know, making the world a better place. You know, this is all of us.
I kind of kept wondering is what they're trying to say is don't beat yourself up. Is Mrs. Fenton or Judy or whatever, are they beating? You can't beat yourself up. They do so much good. Don't beat yourself up because we're not perfect. You know, don't overexpect. And
don't take yourself off the hook because you think you're not up
perfect.
To it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that
yeah.
direction better.
Right. Right. I mean, it's both, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just wondering about that one.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so she gets the job done, and then that wonderful way of saying, you can be in a room, we just all hear everything differently, and all of our reactions, mm-hmm. and important not to, again, make assumptions about people, because we don't know who's, you know. Okay.
Thank you.
What? On to trifle. Yes. Trifle.